Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Different Flesh by Harry Turtledove, narrated by Paul Woodson. 1610. Vilest beast. Simia quam similis. Turpissima bestia nobis. The ape, vilest beast. How like us. Ennius, quoted in Cicero, De Natura Deorum. Europeans found the New World a very different land from the one they had left. No people came down to the seashore to greet their ships. Before the arrival of European settlers, there were no people in North or South America. The most nearly human creatures present in the America were Sims. In the Old World, Sims have been extinct for hundreds of thousands of years. Fossils of creatures very much like present-day Sims have been found in East Africa, on the island of Java, and in caves not far from Pekin, China. Sims must have crossed a land bridge from Asia to North America during an early glacial period of the Ice Age, when the sea level was much lower than it is now. At the time when humans discovered the New World, small hunting and gathering bands of Sims lived throughout North and South America. Their lives were more primitive than those of any human beings, for they knew how to make only the most basic stone and wood tools, and were not even able to make fire for themselves, although they could use and maintain it if they found it. Paradoxically, this very primitiveness makes them interesting to anthropologists, who see in them an illustration of how humanity's ancient ancestors must have lived. Despite their lack of weapons, more formidable than chipped stones and sticks with fire-hardened points, Sims often proved dangerous to colonists in the early days of European settlement of the New World. As they learned to cope with attacks from bands of Sims, the settlers also had to learn new farming techniques needed for soils and climates different from those of their native lands. Hunger was their constant companion in the early years of the colonies. Another reason for this was the necessity of bringing all seed grain across the Atlantic until surpluses could be built up. The Americas offered no native equivalent of wheat, rye, or barley for settlers to use. Sims, of course, knew nothing of agriculture. Nevertheless, the Spaniards and Portuguese succeeded in establishing colonies in Central and South America during the 16th century. The first English settlement in what is now the Federated Commonwealths was at Jamestown, Virginia, in 1607. From The Story of the Federated Commonwealths by Ernest Simpson, reproduced by permission. After 30 mild English summers, July in Virginia smote Edward Wingfield like a blast from hell. Sweat poured off him as he tramped through the forest a few miles from Jamestown in search of game. It clung greasily in the humid heat. He held his crossbow cocked and ready. He also carried a loaded pistol in each boot, but the crossbow was silent and accurate at longer range, and it wasted no precious powder. The guns were only for emergencies. Wingfield studied the dappled shadows. A little past noon, he guessed. Before long he would have to turn round and head home for the colony. He had had a fairly good day. Two rabbits, several small birds, and a fat gray squirrel hung from his belt. He looked forward to fall and the harvest. If all went well this year, the colony would finally have enough wheat for bread and porridge and ale. How he wished, how all the Europeans wished, that this godforsaken new world offered wheat or barley or even oats of its own. But it did not, so all seed grain had to cross the Atlantic. Jamestown had lived mostly on game and roots for 3 years now. Lean and leathery, Wingfield had forgotten what a hot, fresh loaf tasted like. He remembered only that it was wonderful. Something stirred in the undergrowth ahead. He froze. The motion came again. He spied a fine, plump rabbit, its beady black eyes alert, its ears cocked for danger. Moving slowly and steadily, hardly breathing, he raised the crossbow to his shoulder, aimed down the bolt. Once the rabbit looked toward him. He stopped moving again until it turned its head away. He pressed the trigger. The bolt darted and slammed into a tree trunk a finger's breadth above the rabbit's ear. The beast bounded away. Hellfire! Wingfield dashed after it, yanking out one of his pistols. He almost tripped over the outflung branch of a grapevine. The vine's main stalk was as big around as his calf. Virginia grapes, and the rough wine the colonists made from them, were among the few things that helped keep Jamestown bearable. The panic-stricken rabbit, instead of diving into the bushes for cover and losing itself there, burst past a screen of brush into a clearing. "Your last mistake, beast," Wingfield cried in triumph. He crashed through the brush himself, swinging up the gun as he did so. By then the rabbit was almost to the other side of the clearing. He saw it thrashing in the grass there. Wingfield paused, puzzled. Had a ferret torn out its throat as it scampered along, oblivious to everything but its pursuer? Then his grip tightened on the trigger, for a sim emerged from a thicket and ran toward the rabbit. It had not seen him. It bent down by the writhing beast, smashed in the rabbit's head with a rock. Undoubtedly it had used another to bring the animal down. Sims were deadly accurate throwing sharpened stones. Wingfield stepped into the clearing. The colony was too hungry to let any food go. The sim heard him. It rose, clutching the bloody rock in a large, knobby, knuckled hand. It was about as tall as the Englishman, and naked but for its own abundant hair. Its long, chinless jaw opened to let out a hoot of dismay. Wingfield gestured with the pistol. Sims had no foreheads to speak of above their bone-ridged brows, but they had learned the colonists' weapons slew at a distance greater than they could cast their rocks. Usually these days they retreated instead of proving the lesson over again. This one, though, stood its ground, baring broad yellow teeth in a threatening grimace. Wingfield gestured again more sharply, and hoped he seemed more confident than he felt. If his first shot missed, or even wounded but failed to kill, he would have to grab for his other gun while the sim charged, and pistol range was not that much more than a stone's throw. Then the bushes quivered on the far side of the clearing, and a second sim came out to stand behind its fellow. This one carried a large, sharp-edged rock ready to hurl. It shook its other fist at Wingfield and shouted angrily. It was the Englishman's turn to grind his teeth. If both sims rushed him, he would never have the chance to reload either a pistol or his crossbow. The odds of stopping them with just two shots were not worth betting his life on, not for a rabbit. And if they did kill him, they would not content themselves with the game he carried. They would eat him, too. Raising the pistol in a final warning, he drew back into the woods. The sims' mocking cries followed him. He hated the filthy animals, if they were animals. Close to a century had passed since the Spaniards brought the first pair back to Cadiz from their coastal fortress of Veracruz. Churchmen and scholars were still arguing furiously over whether sims were mere brute beasts or human beings. At the moment, Wingfield was ready to hate them no matter what they were. He found the tree where he had shot at the rabbit the sims were now doubtless gulping down raw. He managed to cut himself while he was digging out the crossbow bolt with his knife. That did nothing to improve his temper. Had he shot straight in the first place, he would not have put himself in the humiliating position of backing down from sims. Thinking such dark thoughts, Wingfield turned back toward Jamestown. He scratched at his nose as he walked along and felt skin peel under his nails. One more annoyance. He was too fair not to burn in this climate, but found wearing a hat equally intolerable. On his way home, he knocked over a couple of quail and one of the native beasts that looked like giant white-faced rats, but tasted much better. That improved his mood, a little. He was still grumbling when Alan Cooper hailed him from the edge of the cleared ground. Thinking of the guard's misery made him ashamed of his own bad temper. Cooper wore a gleaming back and breast with thick padding beneath. A heavy plumed morion sat on his head. In that armor, he had to be steaming like a lobster boiled in its own shell. Yet he managed a cheery wave for Wingfield. "Good bag you have there," he called. "It should be better by one hair," Wingfield replied, pique flaring again. He explained how he had lost the beast to the sims.
"Aye, well, no help for such things sometimes, not two on one.
Cooper sighed, and Wingfield felt relief at having his judgment sustained by a professional soldier. The guard went on.
The thieving devils are robbing traps again, too. Henry Dale came in empty-handed this afternoon, swearing foul enough to damn himself on the spot. If swearing damns a man, Henry was smelling brimstone long years ere this, Wingfield observed.
Cooper laughed.
You speak naught but the truth there, though I don't blame him for his fury this time. Sims are worse than foxes ever were.
Foxes have no hands. He hefted his matchlock musket. Without guns, we'd never keep them from our own animals. And how often have they raided the henhouse?
Too many times.
Wingfield turned to a less gloomy subject.
How is Cecil?
Doing splendidly, Cooper said, his voice full of pride. The lad will be 3 months tomorrow.
Cecil Cooper was Jamestown's oldest child. The first ship carrying women had reached Virginia only a year before. Wingfield had a daughter, Joanna, only a few weeks younger than the guard's son. He left Cooper and walked down the muddy path through the fields. Several rows of thatch-roofed cabins stood by the log stockade that mounted cannon. On the other side of the fortress were longer rows of graves. More than half of the original 3 shiploads of colonists had died from starvation or disease. A couple of the newest burials were pathetically small. Even back in England, so many infants did not live to grow up, and life was far harsher here. But the marker that grieved Wingfield most was one of the oldest, the one showing where Captain John Smith lay. Always eager to explore, he had set about learning the countryside from the day the English landed, until the Sims killed him 3 months later. Without him, the settlement seemed to have a lesser sense of drive, of purpose. Still it went on, as people and their works do. Several colonists swung the gates of the fortress open, so others could drive in the pigs, goats, and oxen for the night to protect them from the Sims and other predators. The pigs and goats, which ate anything they came across, throve in this new land. The oxen had the same gaunt look as most of the colonists. Wingfield's cabin was in the outer row, closest to the forest. Smoke rose from the chimney as he approached. The door stood open to let in what air would come. Hearing her husband's step, Anne Wingfield came out to greet him. He hugged her close, so glad she had chosen to spend her life with him. She had had her pick of suitors, as was true of all the women in Virginia. Men outnumbered them 4 to 1. She exclaimed in pleasure at how much game he had brought home. Back in London she would have been nothing special to look at, a rather husky, dark-haired girl in her early 20s with strong features, if anything, handsome rather than pretty. On this side of the Atlantic, though, she was by definition a beauty.
"And how is Joanna?"
Wingfield asked, as his wife skinned and disjointed his 2 rabbits and tossed the meat into the stewpot. The rabbits shared it with a small piece of stale venison from a couple of days before, and a mess of wild onions, beech nuts, mushrooms, and roots. The smell was heavenly.
"Asleep now," Anne said, nodding toward the cradle. "But very well. She smiled at me again this morning."
Maybe next time she will do it in the night, so I may see it too.
I hope she will.
While they waited for the rabbits to cook, they dealt with the rest of Wingfield's catch, cutting the meat into thin strips and setting them on racks over the fire to dry and smoke. After what seemed an eternity, Anne ladled the stew into wooden bowls. Wingfield licked his clean. Though matters were not so grim as they had been the first couple of dreadful winters, he was always hungry.
"I would have had another coney, but for the Sims," he said, and told Anne of the confrontation.
Her hand jumped to her mouth.
"Those horrid beasts! They should all be hunted down and slain, ere they harm any more of our good Englishmen. What would I have done here alone, save only for Joanna, had they hurt you?"
"No need to fret over mud of beans. I'm here and hail," he reassured her, and got up and embraced her for good measure. "As for the Sims, if they be men, slaying them out of hand so would burden us with a great weight of sin when we are called to the Almighty."
"They are no creatures of his," Anne returned, "but rather of the devil, the best he could do toward making true humankind.
I've heard that argument before. To me it smacks of the Manichaean heresy. Only God has the power to create, not Satan.
Then why did he shape such vile parodies of ourselves, his finest creatures? The Sims know nothing of farming or weaving or any useful art. They cannot even set fires to cook the beasts they run down like dogs.
But they know fire, though I grant they cannot make it. Yet whenever lightning sets ablaze, some Sim will play Prometheus and seize a burning brand. They keep the flames alive as long as they may, till they lose them from rain or sheer fecklessness. Anne set hands on hips, gave Wingfield a dangerous look.
When last we hashed this over, as I recollect, 'twas you who reckoned the Sims animals, and I the contrary. Why this reversal?
Why yours? Save your concern for me. He came back.
I thank you for it, but the topic's fit to take from either side. I tell you frankly, I cannot riddle it out in certain, but am changeable as a weather vane, ever thinking now one thing, now the other.
And I, and everyone,
Anne sighed.
But if they put you in danger, my heart cannot believe them true men, no matter what my head might say.
He reached out to set his fingers gently on her arm. The tender gesture was spoilt when a mosquito spiraled down to land on the back of his hand. The swamps round Jamestown bred them in throngs worse than any he had known in England. He swatted at the bug, but it flew off before the death blow landed. Outside, someone struck up a tune on the mandolin, and someone else joined in with a drum. Voices soared in song. The settlers had only the amusements they could make for themselves. Wingfield looked out. Saw a torchlit circle dance forming. He bobbed his head toward his wife.
"Would it please you to join them?"
"Another time," she said. "Joanna will be waking soon and hungry. We could step outside and watch, though."
Wingfield agreed at once. Any excuse to get out of the hot, smelly cabin was a good one. Suitors were buzzing as avidly as the mosquitoes round the few young women who had not yet chosen husbands. Some of those maids owned distinctly fragile reputations. With no others to choose from this side of the sea, they were courted nonetheless.
"Oh, my dear, what would you have me do?"
cried a roguish youngster named Caleb Lucas to a girl who, smiling, had turned her back on him.
"Go off to the woods and marry a Sim?"
Laughter rose, hearty from the men who heard him, half-horrified squeals from the women. "Alan Cooper says the Spaniards do that, or anyway cohabit," Wingfield told Anne. Spain held a string of outposts down to Magellan's Strait and then up the western coast of South America to serve her galleons plying the rich trade with the Indies.
"Have they not read Deuteronomy?"
Anne exclaimed, her lip curling in disgust. Then curiosity got the better of her, and she whispered,
"Can there be issue from such unions?"
"In truth, I don't know. As Alan says, who's to tell the difference betwixt the get of a Spanish sire and that of a Sim?"
Anne blinked, then burst into giggles at the bawdy slander against England's long-time foe. Before long, both she and her husband were yawning. The unremitting labor of building the colony left scant energy for leisure or anything else. Still, Wingfield hesitated before he blew out the last lamp in the cabin. He glanced toward Anne, and saw an answering flush rise from her throat to her cheeks. She was recovered now from the ordeal of childbirth. Perhaps tonight they might start a son. He was about to take Anne in his arms when Joanna let out a yowl. He stopped short. His wife started to laugh. She bared a breast.
"Let me feed her quickly and put her back to sleep. Then, why, we shall see what we shall see."
"Indeed we shall."
Wingfield lay down on the lumpy straw-stuffed bed to wait. He knew at once he had made a mistake, but fell asleep before he could do anything about it. Anne stuck out her tongue at him when the sun woke him the next morning. She skipped back when he reached for her.
"This even," she promised. "We have too much to do of the day to waste it lying abed."
He grimaced.
"You have a hateful way of being right."
He scrambled into trousers and boots, set a plumed hat on his head to shield him from the sun. The plume was a bright pheasant's feather from England, now sadly battered. Soon he would have to replace it with a duller turkey-tail feather. He was finishing a bowl of last night's stew, strong but still eatable, when someone knocked on the cabin door.
"There, you see," Anne said.
"Hush."
He opened the door. Henry Dale came in. He was a short, fussy man whose ruddy complexion and tightly held jaw gave clues to his temper. After dipping his head to Anne, he said,
"Edward, what say we set a few snares today? Mayhap if fortune favours us in spots where no knavish Sims will come on them to go a-poaching."
"Good enough. Alan Cooper told me how you were robbed yesterday."
Anne's presence plainly was the only thing keeping Dale from exploding with fury. He limited himself to a single strangled, "Aye." After a few moments he went on,
"Shall we be about it, then?"
Wingfield checked his pistols, tucked a bundle of crossbow bolts into his belt pouch, nodded. After a too brief embrace with his wife, he followed Dale out into the bright morning. Colonists were already weeding, hoeing, watering in the fields. Caleb Lucas shooed a goat away from the fresh green stalks of wheat, speeding it on with a kick that brought an indignant bleat from the beast.
"And the very same to you," Lucas called after it. "Damned impudent beast! You can find victuals anywhere, so why thieve your betters' meals?"
"Belike the foolish creature thinks itself a sim,"
Dale grunted, watching the goat scurry for the edge of the woods where it began browsing on shoots.
"It lacks the accursed Losel's effrontery, though, for it will not turn on its natural masters. The Sims, now, those horse and beetle-headed flap-eared stinkards."
Without pausing but to draw breath, he continued in that vein until he and Wingfield were surrounded by Forrest. As had Anne's remarks the night before, his diatribe roused Wingfield's contentious nature.
"Were they such base animals as you claim?" he said.
"The Sims would long since have exterminated one another, and not been here for us to find on our landing." Dale gave him a look filled with dislike.
"For all we know, they well nigh did. 'Twas not on us they began their habits anthropophagous."
"If they were eating each other, Henry, and you style them anthropophagous, does that not make men of them?"
Wingfield asked mildly. His companion spluttered and turned even redder than usual. A robin twittered among the leaves. So the colonists named the bird at any rate, but it was not the redbreast of England. It was big and fat and stupid, its underparts the color of brick, not fire. It was, however, easy to kill, and quite tasty. There were other sounds in the woods, too. Somewhere far off, Wingfield heard the deep-throated barking cries of the Sims. So did Henry Dale. He spat deliberately between his feet.
"What men speak so?" he demanded. "Even captured and tamed, as much as one may tame the beasts, they do but point and gape and make a dumb show as a horse will, seeking to be led to manger."
"Those calls have meaning to them," Wingfield said.
"Oh, aye, belike. A wolf in a trap will howl so piteously it frightens its fellows away. Has he then a language?"
Having no good answer to that, Wingfield prudently kept silent. As the two men walked, they looked for signs to betray the presence of small game. Dale, who was an able woodsman when amiable, spotted the fresh droppings that told of a woodchuck run.
"A good place for a snare," he said.
But even as he was preparing to cut a noose, his comrade found a track in the soft ground to the side of the run, the mark of a large bare foot.
"Leave be, Henry," he advised. "The Sims have been here before us."
"What's that you say?"
Dale came over to look at the footprint. One of the settlers might have made it, but they habitually went shod. With a disgusted grunt, Dale stowed away the twine.
"Rot the bleeding blackguards! I'd wish their louse-ridden souls to hell did I think God granted them any."
"The Spaniards baptized them, 'tis said."
"Good on them!"
Dale said, which startled Wingfield until he continued.
"A papist baptism, by Jesus, is the most certain high road to hell of any I know."
They walked on. Wingfield munched on late-ripening wild strawberries, larger and sweeter than any that grew in England.
He spotted a woodchuck ambling from tussock to tussock. This time he aimed with special care, and his shot knocked the beast over. Dale grunted again, now in approval. He had bagged nothing more than a couple of songbirds. They did find places to set several new snares, simple drag nooses, hanging snares made from slip nooses fastened to the ends of saplings, and fixed snares set near bushes. The latter were especially good for catching rabbits. They also visited the snares already set. A horrible stench announced that one of those had taken a black-and-white New World polecat. Skinned and butchered to remove the scent glands, the beast made good eating. Wingfield and Dale tossed a copper penny to see who would have to carry it home. Wingfield lost. Two traps had been sprung but held no game. There were fresh Sim footprints around both. Dale's remarks were colorful and inventive. The Englishmen headed back toward Jamestown not long after the sun began to wester. They took a route different from the one they had used on the way out. Several traps remained to be checked. A small brown and white striped ground squirrel scurried away from Wingfield's boot. It darted into a clump of cockleburrs. A moment later both hunters leaped back in surprise as the little animal was flung head high, kicking in a noose, when a bent sapling suddenly sprang erect.
"Marry," Dale said. "I don't recall setting a snare there."
"Perhaps it was someone else. At all odds, good luck we happened along now."
Wingfield walked over to retrieve the ground squirrel, which now hung limp.
He frowned as he undid the noose from around its neck.
"Who uses sinew for his traps?"
"No one I know," Dale said.
"Twine is far easier to work with."
Wingfield was examining the way the sinew was bound to the top of the sapling. It had not been tied at all, only wrapped around and around several twigs until firmly in place.
"Have a look at this, will you, Henry?"
Dale looked, grunted, turned away. Wingfield's voice pursued him.
"What animals make traps, Henry?"
"Ay, well, this is the first we've seen in all the time we've been this side of the Atlantic. I take that to mean the Sims but ape us, as a jackdaw will human speech, without having the divine spark of wit to devise any such thing for themselves. Damn and blast, man, if a dog learns to walk upon his hinder feet, is he then deserving of a seat in Parliament?"
"More than some who have them now," Wingfield observed.
Both men laughed. Dale reached for the ground squirrel, tossed it into the bag with the rest of the game he carried. His crooked teeth flashed in a rare grin.
"It does my heart good to rob the vermin this once, instead of the other way round."
His good humour vanished when he and Wingfield returned to the settlement. They found not only Alan Cooper and the other three guards armed and armoured, but also a double handful more men. That morning a Sim had burst out of the woods, smashed in a goat's skull with a rock, flung the animal under an arm and escaped, before the startled Englishman could do anything.
"I shot, but I missed," Cooper said morosely.
"It's a poor trade for a ground squirrel, Henry," Wingfield remarked.
His hunting partner's scowl was midnight black.
"The mangy pests grow too bold. Just the other night they slaughtered a hound outside the stockade, hacked it to pieces with their stones, and were eating the flesh raw, when at last the sentry came round with his torch and spied them.
He missed too,"
Dale finished, with a sidelong look at Cooper.
"And would you care to draw a conclusion from that?" the guard asked.
His hand caressed the hilt of his rapier. Henry Dale hesitated. As a gentleman he was trained to the sword, but liverish temper or no, he was not a fool. Cooper had learned in a harsher school than his and survived. At last Dale said,
"I draw the same conclusion as would any man of sense, that our best course is to rid ourselves of these pestiferous Sims forthwith, as wolves and other vicious creatures have long been hunted out of England."
"I hold to war, Henry, on being attacked, but not to murder," Cooper said. "Mind, we must seem as outlandish to them as they to us."
"Killing a Sim is no more murder than butchering a pig," Dale retorted. The endless debate started up again.
Having no desire to join in another round, Wingfield took his share of the game back to his cabin. Anne was changing Joanna's soiled linen.
She looked up with a wan smile.
There's no end to it.
The baby kicked her legs.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?